warm welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. My name is Henrik, and this is Internet Talk Radio from the west coast of Sweden. Thank you for tuning in. Nice to have you along. On Thursdays and Sundays, we are here highlighting research and information for your consideration. And we do not tell you what to think or what you should believe. We try to present the information in the best way we can and help to highlight the research of authors, filmmakers, and researchers, and bring their information to your attention. We do not claim that we know or are presenting the truth about everything, but we are searching for truth, and we are trying to find out what has been going on in the past, what is going on now, and what we might expect in the future. And we think that you should make up your own mind about the subjects that we cover and continue the search for yourself if you find it interesting. So dare to explore the world and consequently yourself. Our website is redicecreations.com. Stop by for frequently updated news, links, resources, videos. We have our member section up there, the forums, and much more. And today on the program, we have Neil Kramer back with us. You might remember our first show that we did with Neil back in December last year. And Neil is behind the website slash blog The Cleaver. He writes on many important subjects relating to awakening, consciousness, also manipulation, and how to kind of break free from the hive mentality and how to find yourself in all of this. Very important and interesting material. And we have quite a few different things that we're going to talk about today. The gates of awakening, increasing polarity of consciousness, LRP, flash analysis. I have no idea what that is. That's going to be very interesting talking more about that. Imagination and field uplink, and also finding oneself or locating oneself in all of this. Very good stuff indeed, and it's going to be very interesting diving into this with Neil here today. And you can, of course, find more of Neil's writing at thecleaver.blogspot.com. That's thecleaver.blogspot.com. Many excellent articles up there for you to dive into. So with that, it's been a while, but it's very nice to have you back on the program, Neil. Welcome.
Hello, Henrik. It's great to be back here.
So, I mean, how have you been? You continue to be, creative. You've been writing. You've been producing. Is everything good over there in the UK?
Yeah. It's excellent. Thank you. I think it's one of those times where everything seems to be kind of accelerating, and time just really seems to be just disappearing into a black hole, really. So I'm just trying to grab as much as I can of the time that is available for myself and keep studying, keep exploring, experiencing. And as I was just kind of looking over your website earlier today, and you know, one of your taglines is like, be here now. And yes. I think that's you know, extremely important thing to do straight away if you can, to avoid disappearing into someone else's mind.
Very good point. Very important. And I mean, if we think about time as such, or time disappearing, or you know, going faster and faster in a way, do you think that that's related to our consciousness, or is this actually an external thing, that time is actually speeding up in some way?
I think very much time is a construct which helps us navigate around the world. And you know, if a dimensional shift comes about, which it certainly looks like it will do, I think time is the first thing that's going to be jettisoned, and is the first thing that's going to be dropped and left behind entirely. So it's a difficult question, and perhaps it's both, you know, consciousness certainly, external, it certainly seems to be that too. From my perspective, I've always quite admired the Mayan map, which is their calendar really charting the development of consciousness in ever accelerating cycles. And according to that, we're in the, you know, the final cycle right at the top of the pyramid, which is a cycle of only a few years, really, with, of course, the zenith in 2012, which, as I've said to numerous people who have discussed this with, I don't think 2012 is what I call like a light switch moment where something suddenly happens and everything changes in an extraordinary way. I think it's purely the peak of a graph, you know, the top point of a graph where things are at their height of complexity and possible singularity. So Yes and yes is the short answer.
Very good. Yeah, you know, I agree with you there, and I think, again, it's important to emphasize that with 2012, it as you said, it has been said before, but it needs to be said again that to focus on that as a point of change is can be very you know, diluting, so to speak, as well. People are focusing on that and actually might not incorporate any change in their own lives because they're focusing on that as a point of reference. So, oh no, just wait until that point and things will be better or worse or whatever it is that you're waiting for. But I think it's important to begin straight away. Why wait, right?
Yes, it's a good point. It's really 2012 is in danger of becoming a sort of contemporary new age redeemer victim religion where everybody sits on the backside waiting for the savior moment, whether it's in the shape of a person or an entity or an extraterrestrial or an event or whatever. So I'm certainly not putting money on anything, and I'm certainly not waiting for anything. I'm just, you know, carrying on as fast as I can and as purposefully and determined as I can. So 2012 is something to keep an eye on and study and be observant and aware of, but not a focal point in terms of one's own activities.
Yes. We had a few points here that we want to go through today, a few chapters, if you will. And the first one is The Gates of Awakening. And you wrote to me, the natural process of how consciousness is engaged, challenged, and raised. Tell us a little bit about that, Neil.
Yeah, The Gates of Awakening is my shorthand, really, my little technique for analyzing the process that seems to be what I would consider a very natural process, whereby humans come into the world, they engage with certain activities, they unveil certain truths and untruths, and they expand their consciousness, and they begin to integrate these new powers into their life. And those kind of sections can be brought down into discrete individual units. So what I've observed is that there is a certain succession of energies from one movement to another. So it's I've described it elsewhere as a kind of transcendental energy model, but really just easier English language is Gates of Awakening. So in my model, the first thing that happens when, you know, you say to a lot of your guests, for example, and on other shows and TV shows and so on, you know, tell us your story, tell us how you got into this, mm-hmm. and how your consciousness moved and what opened your eyes and what was the event that happened to you. In my model, that is what I would call the engagement stage. So this is really the thing, you know, that a lot of people approach typically in the first third of the life, although there are exceptions and some people do this later on, where you'll find something that engages your consciousness and your attention. So it could be something like ancient civilizations and Egyptians, early Christianity, Mayans, Toltecs, whatever,
yeah.
or Atlanteans, Lemurians, etc. And for other people, they say, oh no, I don't want to do that. I'm not much a historian. I'm more interested in conspiracy and ghosts and things like that. Mm. And for other people who are much more, shall we say, left brain minded, they may say, well, for me, the thing that engages me is physics and botany or cosmology or quantum theory. So the engagement process is different for everybody, but it's a key stage that says, okay, the universe is pretty big and mysterious and interesting, and your way into it is going to be through a subject that engages your attention, that expands your consciousness and gives you energy, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So that engagement process typically lasts, you know, a number of years. And for me, you know, I was quite interested in philosophy, for example. So I kind of studied, you know, the ancient philosophers like Pythagoras and Socrates and Plato and so on,
mm-hmm.
and then kind of skipped whole eras of medieval and Renaissance and Enlightenment and went to the, 19th century and 20th century philosophers. So for me, I was interested in other people who sat back and thought, this isn't surely the way things are. This isn't surely the world as it has been taught to us in schools. There seems to be something much more fundamental, something so huge we can't actually see it. And, you know, these guys approach that as a philosophical problem, which is quite interesting, which is a good way of doing it. What then tends to happen is the second gate, if you like, and there are analogues for this in Zen Buddhism and also in Toltec shamanism, their own ways of measuring this progress of consciousness. But for mine, I've termed it the gates of awakening just for my own use. Mm. The second stage is what I call the unveiling stage. And there are two aspects to this. There is the shadow and the dark side, and there is the light side and the energy side. So a dark unveiling, for example, would be something like the study of the secret societies and, you know, Illuminist groups, yes. Masons, Rosicrucians, Knights of Malta, and then the more kind of geopolitical reflections of that, like the Bilderbergers, Council on Foreign Relations, Tavistock, etc. Mm. Many of which, of course, stem from these ancient mystery cults and, you know, this extreme stratification of knowledge and technology, which they keep to themselves and deny to everybody else. Mm. And one interesting thing that characterizes this unveiling stage is that many people, particularly those who focus on the dark stuff, will come to light unveilings in a minute, but the dark unveilings, it's very easy to get stuck at that stage. And it's very easy to find yourself kind of mired in all the information and disinformation and infighting and intrigues, yes. and so on and so forth. Yeah. And I'm sorely tempted to give examples, but I'll try and be professional and not do that.
Right. Yes.
But I'm sure we can use our imaginations of people who you can imagine have found themselves in stasis, you know, hibernating at that stage. So it is easy to do. And I'm sure that the kind of cognitive dissonance that one finds in one's own life when you arrive at that place is very uncomfortable. Yes. And in psychological terms, one way of dealing with cognitive dissonance is distraction. So it is easy to distract yourself with, you know, endlessly researching all the different twists and turns of the conspiracy. So in this process, it's important to switch from the dark to the light unveilings. Examples of that are things like the core understanding, the core comprehension that the three-dimensional world in front of us is not actually there as such. It's a brain construct. It's a mind construct. And it's there for navigational purposes only. And in and of itself, it does not exist. It is maya. It is illusory in its very heart. That is a very basic light unveiling, but certainly one that's driven me down this road pretty hard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you approach that information, you can do it from a mystical point of view through religious and semi-religious and ancient mystery cults and, you know, more enlightened kind of ways of thought. Or you can do it through science, and you can look at string theory. You can look at what people are doing at CERN with the Large Hadron Collider and so on.
Yes.
The basic message, though, and a lot of people are focusing on this, particularly people like Greg Braden, who I know you've had on very recently, he's saying consciousness, yes, consciousness creates reality. It is the fabric of reality. It's, to some extent, what I term the programming language of reality. And science and mysticism seem to be slowly and gingerly, you know, approaching each other and shaking hands on this and saying, yeah, we think we can agree on some consensus a little bit here, whereas science studies the phenomenology of that. Religion studies the, you know, moral and personal implications of that.
Yes.
So those are the two sides of the unveiling stage. The third stage, the third gate, is what I call expansion. And this is the interesting bit, really. You can't go to expansion properly unless you have engaged yourself with information, unless you have unveiled the various untruths of the world. So it's difficult to expand your mind unless you've done that, which is why we find so many seemingly intelligent, psychologically astute people failing to expand the consciousness because they have not gone through the process, particularly the unveiling process. Without that, the ego will lock out any expansion altogether. Hmm. So this thing is...
Let's pause right there. Why do you think that is? Is that a function of consciousness in a way to how should I put it, prevent you from going further? What do you think?
Function of the ego, you mean?
Yeah, exactly, right.
Yeah. Yeah, the ego is very much what I would consider a survival mechanism. And so the ego's job is essentially to keep you alive, to make sure you eat and drink and sleep and fuck and keep warm and so on. That's what it's there for. Theoretically, in the brain, it comprises your defensive, instinctive, and what in neurology is called your executive functions. So it places, when it's artificially inflated, the ego places a cap or a limit on the advancement along the path of transcendence, because it says, I can't operate on this basic, you know, militaristic level if you're going to think about the finer consciousness and the spiritual paths of life. Mm. It's a little bit like taking a kind of, you know, hard-boiled soldier and saying, okay, we're going to take all your kit away, we're going to take all your weapons away, we're going to put you in this robe, and we're going to make you study Zen Buddhism. You know, it's a little bit like that. That's an image to take with you, yeah.
Right, right.
It's not going to happen. So the ego's job is fundamentally to keep you alive and to cap its progress at that point. As we'll discover later on, the control system has intentionally, and for those who don't know who I am, the control system is my terminology for a complex of systems like the Illuminati, the globalists, the mystery cults, and so on. Let's just, the controllers, yeah.
Yes.
So control system is a purposefully neutral term to avoid anybody getting, you know, kind of overexcited, or as the terminology changes, sometimes it's not appropriate to say Illuminati because it isn't strictly true.
Sure.
And also the Illuminati have a lot of interesting and, how can I put it, solid, good information in their canon. And I don't see why they should kind of keep that. So I use a term that avoids that.
Yes.
Anyway, back to the point. The control system amplifies the ego to the point where the ego is the thing that, in a way, is driving your life to say, okay, it's a reductionist material process. The ego is only interested in that which fulfills itself, that which sustains the biological entity.
Yes.
And it doesn't see transcendence as part of that process. So I hope that explains and fleshes it out a little bit.
That's very good. That gives a background, so to speak, on the journey of awakening and what needs to be taken place for the full process to happen. And I just want to, you know, go back a little bit and talk about that idea that when one studies, as you call it, the dark side of that, when you're, you know, finding out what the heck is going on around you and who's controlling the world and so forth, I think that all these stages are in themselves tremendously necessary and very important for the completeness of this to take place, so to speak. And I think it's worth to emphasize that again, the danger, as you mentioned, of potentially being locked down in a specific situation or don't move on from one area, because to study how evil everyone else is around you but to know nothing about yourself, that doesn't sound, you know, too nice to me, at least. It's like the focus is so external all the time that one tends to forget, you know, oneself in all this, and also, of course, the participatory role that oneself has in all of this, meaning that am I actually bringing this about in some way? Is the fact that I'm focusing on this so much, is that contributing to the worldview of that I'm totally always, you know, experience the fact that I'm being they're all against me, or, you know, this is only the picture of the world that is emerging here? Because again, what you focus on, that becomes a part of your reality. So what I just like to put in there is to say that it's also a danger into just looking at, again, how evil everyone else is, but to know nothing about yourself.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think that everybody who finds themselves in that ranting stage, which is understandable initially, you have to understand that that is a stage. It's not a destination. It's not, okay, now you know the truth of how shit the world is. You have to stay there, and that's the way it is going to remain. That isn't the case at all. I think people who get stuck there have an inherent psychological vulnerability, which is not to be underestimated, which will collapse them at that point. And I think that the control system's torrent of misinformation is purposefully to exploit that vulnerability in people, because it is well aware that the discomfort that comes with knowing the world is not the way you thought it was is a trigger point where you will either kind of rocket ahead and develop yourself, or you will begin to devolve and you will ask for prescribed official formalized sedatives like TV and junk food and so on and so forth. So it's very, very simple to do that, and I'm sure that everybody who listens to this knows what I'm talking about. And I think we've all done it from time to time, where things just get too much and you think, okay, I'm just going to sit down, I'm going to watch a, you know, a zombie film, I'm going to eat some crisps, and I'm going to drink some whiskey, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. That's okay, but it can become a formal way of coping with things. And if that is switched, instead of from the TV to the internet, and instead of prescribed formal programming, instead to your own research of the evils of the world, it has very much the same effect, in that over and over again it just becomes an informational sedative.
Yes.
And as we'll come on to later on, one way to keep people from the truth is to overload them with information. So though indeed we do live in a time of revealing, we also live in a time where filtering is absolutely crucial. You cannot just type in car in Google and expect to find the car that's right for you, because you get about 50 billion results. So equally, you have to have a complex set of filters in your mind so you can approach information in an intuitive, discerning, reasonable way.
Yes.
And those things are custom filters that you have to build yourself. So nobody's going to really hand them to you on a plate. You have to construct these things yourself. Otherwise, again, you become overloaded. And when you become overloaded, you need sedating. And that is usually an informational sedation these days.
Very good points, so all of them. And I think, I mean, in a way, what you're talking about there is escape, in a way. And there's, of course, different types of escapes. I mean, for instance, even, you know, immersing yourself only in one type of information, be it studying only conspiracy or only New Age spiritual topics, that can also be a form of escape, or a form of turning off all the stuff that you're not comfortable hearing about, or what have you. And then,
yeah,
of course,
that's right. Yeah, yes. Go on, sorry.
No, just, and I also wanted to say, and then, of course, one should not also forget that, hey, wait a minute, what is this all about? We're on this planet, right? This is about balancing the situation here, meaning that if you become too, you know, disciplined in a way that, okay, now I have to study, I have to learn, I have to grow, I have to become better, I have to, you know, all of that stuff, that I feel could also be kind of part of the ego in a way. It's a drive there, and one tends to forget, wait a minute, can I just, you know, relax for a while, have some fun, you know, as you said, put on a zombie flick or what have you, just go out in the woods and do nothing, you know, all day, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because,
yeah,
again, it's about finding that balance and understanding what, you know, what makes you happy as a person, and what is, you know, what life means to you. You know, that's how I feel about it.
Yeah, me too. And I think that from my perspective, when you analyze your own reaction to things in the world, if you overdo it and if you self-analyze too much, again, you get a little bit of burnout. So it is important to go out into the woods and relax and just walk and allow yourself, give yourself permission to say, I'm going to do nothing. I'm going to sit back, whether it's for an hour or a week or whatever you can manage in your own life pattern. It's important to be able to sit back and look at the sky and walk through the grass and touch the trees and speak to your friends and, you know, go out and eat something wonderful somewhere, you know, to liaise and connect and to facilitate these things within your life. Otherwise, you end up as this kind of sick tunnel researcher, which is really going to destroy you, and it's ultimately going to compromise the integrity of what you're doing. So this process, this gate of unveiling is a key one, and a lot of people get waylaid at that point. And, you know, if a huge party of researchers approach these gates, you know, in a big horde, at that gate, a lot of them would fall over and get left behind, and fewer and fewer and fewer proceed to the next gate, which is, as we were saying, which was expansion. So if you can persuade your ego to allow you to expand, and this is very much a thing that you have to compel the ego to do. So the ego is trying to, it thinks it's doing you a favor. It thinks it's saying, look, I know what's best for us. The best thing you can have is nice food, a nice girlfriend, a nice house, a nice car, and then that's okay, and that's all you need, really. So that has to be upturned to some extent. And as a few researchers that I've been looking at recently, old books actually that I've dug out of my archive, there's a guy called Bob Frissell and a guy called Drunvalo Melchizedek.
Right.
That's an interesting name, difficult to pronounce.
Yes.
As they've stated in their works, the left brain has to be persuaded of the wider realities of the Akashic field and the matrix and the control system before it can assimilate any new knowledge or upgrade itself. And this has to be taught and compelled into the left brain, to trust the right brain. The left brain being, for anyone who's not familiar with this, left brain being kind of logic and, reason and rational reductionist views, the right brain being more creative, dynamic, spontaneous, and so on.
Yes.
So the right brain is more likely to get you somewhere interesting, and you do need both, but the right brain is chronically undervalued in our society, so you have to train it, you have to kind of pump that muscle to get it working, otherwise it's going to atrophy and disappear. So
yes,
you have to persuade it. So the left brain, you have to have a conversation and say, look, I know you're trying to, facilitate the ego's desire to keep us all happy and smiling and alive and well fed, but right now you have to understand that the way of transcendence, which is ultimately the only thing we're here for, is going to be through our friend the right brain. Yeah. So that's how it works, and there's various things to get those two to speak to each other. One of them is meditation. One of them is, for example, playing a musical instrument. It's one of the few things you can do to create a harmonic resonance between these different portions of the brain. Strictly speaking, it's not quite as simple as left and right brain. I'm aware of that.
Yes.
But it's nice shorthand for the purposes of conversation. When I was writing some of this stuff down for something I've been producing recently, there was a 1996 conference on brain development in young children at the University of Chicago. And one of the presentations stated that the years from 4 to 10 are the kind of wonder years of learning, when a child can easily pick up foreign languages and easily learn a musical instrument. And this is chiefly because the brain at that stage is more naturally balanced and less compartmentalized. So the left-right brain is very indistinct at that stage. Mm. And the brain is much easier, finds it much easier to assimilate and interpret and categorize and process information. So to some extent, if you get them young, then you can just make growth and learning disappear. Or as Robert Anton Wilson said, every child is intensely curious until they get to school. And the function of school, yeah, and the function of school is to kill that curiosity by telling them that there is only one answer,
yeah,
that we already know the answer, and don't do any thinking of your own.
Yeah.
So curiosity, if you swap that with the evolution of consciousness, or the raising of consciousness, or the assimilation of gnosis, then learning and education is the only reason we're here. And there is only a very small proportion of people that you'll meet in your life who value learning after the age of about 25. So even in Western Europe, which is supposedly, the height of cultural and academic intelligence on the planet, which is dubious, but I understand that. Even there, most people reject education after 25 and just say, okay, I've done that now. It was crap. I didn't enjoy it. Yeah. So from now on, I'm just going to seek pleasure and distraction and escape. And it's a sad state of affairs. So yeah, unless you stumble upon your own engagement, going back to that first gate, that's the way it stays. And the control system is very happy for you to do that, because thick, sick, stupid people are fantastic consumers and also very easy to govern.
That's right.
And, you can look up those quotes by politicians like Henry Kissinger from way back in the 50s and 60s, right up until today, with modern politicians who off record or in party meetings where they have these little breakout sessions in little tiny meetings outside, off the record, they all know that the game is, one game is to say things that appeal to people, but the real game is to have a nice, thick, governable populace.
That's right. Exactly. You're absolutely right there. And again, this is the level that people need to be aware of, that this also is taking place, and there is a kind of administrative purpose for this, if you will, because again, yes, the mentality of these people is reflected in their governing behavior, if you will, as well, meaning that they look upon this only from a, you know, potentially a rational scientific background or mindset, mm-hmm. meaning that they think of the human populace as a herd that needs to be controlled and culled and managed in a best way. And in many cases, I think also that these people are actually thinking that they're doing something right, something good. They're helping the world and things are becoming yep. better, more structured and more controlled, you know. So they're coming potentially, not everyone, of course, there is a hidden occult agenda behind that as well, of course, but let's focus on the first level here and realize that fact, that many people who are into it, politics, what have you, might come from a position where they feel that they're actually doing good, but the question is, are they really, you know?
Sure, yeah, and that leads into this expansion stage, this expansion gate, where, as I, you know, a message that continually occurs and resonates and emanates from my work is the idea of working on yourself, cleaning, detoxing yourself, meditating, evolving yourself. That is the core of the expansion stage. So the research, the interpretation, the study, the distillation of esoteric knowledge, all those things naturally filter toward you when you begin to expand your consciousness. By expansion, I mean literally a physical, a spiritual, a metaphysical expansion, which I'll come to in a bit. But, you know, consciousness creates reality. The linear mind off psychic mind arises, and that is the formula that indicates a lot of the progress on this path. So it becomes evident quite quickly when you study consciousness, especially through the lens of quantum theory, that at root consciousness is a non-local process, and it does not reside in your brain. It's not a little thing sat in your head. It's not in any danger of destruction. It's not going to be rubbed out by anything that anyone does to you. Consciousness is better conceived of as an uplink to the field, the universal field, which many people have different names for, like the in my cosmology, there is a local field which is described as the Akashic field or the noosphere, depending on your preferred terminology. Mm. And there is also a more universal field, which indeed people call the universal field or the vacuum field. Some people refer to its energetic qualities as the zero point field. In Toltec shamanism, they call it the dark sea of awareness, or the luminous filaments move within it. And so, depending on, you know, your preferred symbology and what resonates with you and what gives you energy, nevertheless, this field exists. So, as I say, personal experience of reality is better conceived of as your custom tunnel, your custom reality tunnel into this field, which for shorthand I call field uplink, okay?
Yes.
And this has been studied for millennia by the shamans of our world. And again, something I'd like to emphasize, particularly for those who haven't read my stuff or are not familiar with what I believe, shamanism is not some exotic anthropological oddity that you may, you know, the control system would want you to think it is. Shamanism, very opposite of that, is the original spiritual experience of all indigenous peoples, whether they're in North America, Siberia, Sweden, England, Ireland, wherever. Shamanism is the spiritual practice that was that remained all over the planet up until around 10,000 years ago, when it appeared that the personal, individual, and sovereign right to spiritual ascension was removed. And of course, this was done by the co-opted religions,
yes,
which is a whole subject in itself. But suffice to say that by hijacking and editing systems of evolution, Removing the transcendent qualities out of them and concentrating on only the control, you know, the control aspects, this kind of fake priesthood, falsely claimed ownership of many of these things, and, you know, they claim special status and so on and so forth. And I go into this in my work. I think that I would like to imagine that most people listening to this are thinking, yeah, we know all about that. And I think it's pretty much well-established, well-documented fact now that religion is a control system. Yes. If you study the religion and go back far enough, you find that there's incredible knowledge in there that they've nicked from somewhere else. Mm. And as you follow that trail back, it leads further and further and further to much purer sources where some of that knowledge and some of that gnosis was shared liberally and freely and transparently with all the people. So it's not that the information is bad, it's how it's edited and controlled and kind of snipped off and so on.
Yes.
So it's important to make that distinction. But shamanism obviously still exists, and most people associate it with either Native American shamanism or Peruvian Amazonian shamanism. But it's very, very important to the furtherance of consciousness, particularly the use of entheogens and psychedelics and so on and so forth, which again is a whole show in itself. But I would certainly say that the people who practice shamanism are aware that what we call learning and thinking as a cognitive process, they have superseded that by just knowing. And by that I mean that if you can establish good field uplink, good connection to the universal field, mm-hmm. you can connect with any information at anywhere immediately. And so it's a little bit like in the Matrix where, you know, they'll say, okay, I want to know about Kung Fu, put the disc in my head and give it me. Yeah?
Yes, yes.
Or Trinity says, I need to fly that helicopter, I don't know how to do it, give me the disc. Field uplink operates in the same way. When you connect to the field, you connect to everything. So you can have a very low level of academic and scholarly intelligence, and you can even have a very low emotional intelligence, which usually is a great obstacle. However, if you have good uplink, you can just supersede and move way past that in an instant by gathering that information at once. So the shamans are well aware of this and have been for, well, since, you know, at least 150,000 years, I would say.
So what you're saying here basically is that information and knowledge is so widely dispersed within the field here, so to speak, that, you know, a way of reading a book, for example, that's just one way of attaining information or to grow
It's the old-fashioned way to read a book. Is to me is a very beautiful and important thing, and I hope that I can do it for the rest of my life. But nevertheless, that linear way of watching a film or reading a book or listening to some schmuck like me talk on a show is the old-fashioned way of doing it. If you have field uplink, cohesive, coherent field uplink, you can connect to that information already, because in my model of reality, in a fourth dimensional context outside of time, you're no longer restricted to the fact that, well, it hasn't happened yet, so how can I listen to this guy speak or read this book, because it hasn't happened yet. But somebody knows what I know. Somebody has written this book in the past. It exists elsewhere. So all things in a fourth dimensional context, whether they happen today, tomorrow, or yesterday, it doesn't matter. You can go and connect with that event. So the very process of thinking in itself, although it's key to a lot of things we do, is very much an egoic function, you know, an aspect of the ego that rather unsupportively isolates the mind from the universal field. Mm. And as I said in a recent piece, a standard remote viewing technique, which is, you know, viewing things at a distance without actually going there, which the US government piled a lot of money into in the 60s and 70s. Standard remote viewing technique teaches the student not to think. It proposes that the collective unconscious, which is an aspect of the field, a local noospheric aspect of the field of Earth, this knows everything already. And so the kind of brain churn that happens when you think just obscures the picture like static on a TV screen. So we must stop thinking and just learn to step out of the way. Mm. So I remember reading a William Burroughs novel called The Place of Dead Roads, which is one of my favourite books. And in it, he has a number of gunfighter characters. It's kind of, it's not a Western, but it does have Western symbology.
Right.
And one of the characters is learning to shoot, and the master gunslinger who stands with him and says, "Look, I'm gonna show you how to do this." He says, "Look, your eyes and your hands know much more about shooting than you do. All you need to do is step out of the way."
There you go.
Field uplink is very, very similar to that. So meditation is just a way of saying to the ego and to the left brain, "Okay, just shut up a minute, because we're going to do something now."
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a very key process, very, very important. Shamanism will bring all this information to you, particularly modern studies of shamanism. If you go back to the old studies of the 50s and 60s, with one or two exceptions, they're very, very unsupportive, very unhelpful, and patronizing to the natives, as they called them.
Yeah.
Modern interpretations and modern studies are much more open-minded, and I can perhaps send you one or two links to that. But
definitely.
But shamanism, the study of entheogenic sacred plants, meditation, all bring the understanding and control of the process of thinking itself, and they smooth it out, and you know, can cease and stop it altogether. So in Castaneda's version of Toltec shamanism, Don Juan teaches Castaneda to stop the world, in inverted commas, as a means of saying to the ego, as I say, just shut up a minute, because we're going to see into the field here. So there has to be agreement with the ego. So playing a musical instrument begins to instruct a dialogue, begins to initiate a dialogue with left and right brain to say, okay, we're going to speak to each other for a change. We're not just going to fire things over the wall. We're actually going to have dialogue here.
Yes.
And once that happens, left and right brain are much more able to establish field uplink when they work together.
Very good. That's a very good point, I feel, again, because this is about the unison of those two sides, because again, this is not about shutting out or shutting off either one of them, and to make ourselves whole again, make that completeness. Then I feel it's much more. I mean, we can even look at it from the perspective of basic, mind control, if you will, because again, that has to do with the kind of the schizophrenia that they're playing on, that idea that people are shattered and broken up, compartmentalized, exactly, all the time, and so a consequence to work against that, so to speak, or to get a better picture, a better perspective on and also a better understanding is to be complete again, to join the both sides again. And I think that the idea of playing music instruments is a very interesting idea as well, because there you're both being kind of analytical in a way, because you need to be focused on what you're doing with your instrument, with your hands and what have you, but you also need to work with your creativity and your inspiration in a different way. So it's like a dance.
That's right. That's right. And when you have a good musical teacher, I play guitar, and I was lucky enough to have an excellent jazz teacher. I'm not into jazz. I'm more into kind of metal personally. You know, heavy metal and death and stuff, but we won't go into that.
Right.
I don't want to compromise my integrity by telling you about my favorite bands. Anyway, never mind. My guitar teacher, you know, he would say, okay, play these scales, and this is Mixolydian, this is Phrygian, this is Aeolian, these are these modal patterns, these are the chords, these minor, and he would technically teach everything, and I went away and thought, oh, this is cool, you know, and I gradually built up speed and fluency and so on. But the greatest emphasis he placed on what we were doing was, he said, okay, now you can do it. He said, you've got to feel what you're doing. You've got to feel the music now. And that was the hardest thing for me to do. And this is at the age of 12 or whatever, so it was a long time ago.
Mm.
But I didn't understand for weeks and weeks and weeks what the hell he meant by feel the music. I thought, well, I can hear the music. But no, he wasn't saying that. He was, no, not hear it. You've got to feel it. Mm. You've got to feel what that means, and you've got to adjust the volume, and you've got to put some kind of emotional content, like Bruce Lee used to say, emotional content into what you're doing. Without that, it's just a mechanical response,
yeah,
and it's flat, like bad pop music. So with feeling and with emotional content, it communicates so much more, and so much greater degree of beauty.
Yes, well put.
But what you're saying is, it leads nicely into this last gate. So just to kind of recap, we said, okay, gate one, sounds like a game show. Gate one is engagement. Gate two is unveiling. Gate three is expansion. The final gate is integration. And this is what you've just led into, which is that integration means bringing everything you know together and creating harmony. Essentially, for me, it means walking the path. Once you understand what the path is, the path of transcendence and the path of evolution and self-gnosis and so on, you can read about it and you can sit there and you can read about it in your lunch break and you can do this and do that. Sooner or later, you've actually got to walk that path.
Yes.
And take some risks and get out there and do it and jettison some of the safety measures that you have in your life and some of the nice comforts. You have to walk away from those to some extent. So there's a classical spiritual path of asceticism and of hardship that gets you through that, and that it's the only way to actually do it. And this thing is all about bringing about this harmonious balance of selfhood and individuality. The arch enemy of the control system is individuality.
Yes.
with a coherent connection to the universal field or the oneness or whatever you want to call it, but it's creating this attunement, again, this kind of musical concept, which allows your brain to do what it's supposed to do, which is act in a much more holistic fashion, and also for there to be less obstructions and less obstacles to your expansion of consciousness, and to have a more harmonious relationship with what is your truth, with living your own truth, and you know, your authentic life, what you actually know you should be doing and where you really should be going and what you shouldn't be doing as well. So you have to sometimes begin to define it by saying, it's a very difficult question to answer, to say, I don't know what I want to do. It's much easier to say, I know what I don't want to do, though. So sometimes you might have to twist it around and start from that point. But sooner or later, you begin to understand that your life, really, all lives are about working, you know, with the universe, with the higher self of your own being, to unfold your own transcendence, and that's what it's all about. So these gates of awakening, you know, lead higher and higher and higher, and you know, the staircase that leads up is quite a thing to perceive, and you can't jump from step one to step 100 in one go. Right. You have to walk up these things, you know, one by one. And if you looked from the bottom to the top, you'd think, Jesus, you know, it's too difficult. I don't think I'll bother, actually. So there are these milestones along the way, and, you know, various people categorize them in different ways. This is my system. This is my symbology.
Yes.
These are the four gates that I perceive, and some of the, you know, positives and negatives for each of them. So I hope that's an interesting system. I just thought it'd be cool to, you know, share that.
Oh yeah, definitely very important. And also, you know, one thing that we can say here is that, to as you mentioned, you talked about it as looking up, you know, towards this high point with an incredible amount of steps or stairs. We also need not to focus on what is at the top of that thing right now, also in a way, because we can take one step at a time and enjoy where we're at that moment. And you know, before you know it, you're going to have a pretty nice view, you know. So
yeah, absolutely. That's a key point. If somebody's sat around thinking, well, what's at the top? What does it all mean? Why are we here? If you were given that information without the proper ascension, you would just blow your head off. It would just obliterate your whole being. This thing has to be perceived, this transcendental object at the end of time, as Terence McKenna called it. I see it as something different. I see it as a gradual journey down this kind of fractal spiral, to say, as you increase in your intelligence, as your consciousness increases, it gives you a greater capacity to travel deeper down this fractal spiral, so that, as I've said in a recent piece, that each lifetime you live is a frequency, is a resolution of this fractal, leading to, you know, grander and more beautiful structures within it that we ourselves are helping to articulate with our consciousness. So consciousness is the construction material of this spiral. So our lives, our individual lives and our collective lives, represent the movement of this fractal spiral through time.
Yes, beautifully put, and I think that's a good place to begin to round things up here for the our first segment. We've been talking about the Gates of Awakening. Of course, this has led us into a little bit of the field uplink and imagination and so forth. But we need to talk more about the increasing polarity of consciousness. That's very interesting, and also how to find oneself or locating oneself in all of this. So we have much more to talk about here next up in our member section. But in the first segment here, Neil, is there something you'd like to leave us with? I also, of course, want you to mention your website so people can find more of your writing.
Yeah, I think from my perspective, the message I try and give to people through my work, and sometimes I go into a lot of detail and sometimes I keep it quite light, but throughout each pole of what I do, whether it's dense or whether it's spiritually active, the core message is you have to go your own way. You have to work on yourself. And whatever's coming down the pipe to greet us over the coming years is a personal, extremely intimate test for all of us. So there's nothing that is going to be televised as such, and what you see through the TV, as we all know, is just horseshit, really. So that's to be moved away from as quickly as possible. What happens in the world is rather an existentialist, rather an intimate experience, and those things can only be approached and can only be brought into being through working on yourself, improving yourself, growing, learning, etc. Those are the only things we're here for, and that is an eternal journey. Along the way, there's a lot of cool stuff and a lot of brilliant things to see, but that journey in itself also is the automatic release from the kind of manacles of the control system. So all the bad aspects and all the terrible people and all the dreadful things that they do, those things begin to evaporate as you work on yourself. So you have to get rid of the idea that it's a selfish activity. There's no selfishness involved in here. It's a complete false construct. This is perfectly acceptable as a compassionate, generous way to live your life. Somebody once said to me, how can a Tibetan monk sat in a cave possibly contribute to the world? What do they achieve by doing that? If you have the wider perspective of the universal field and of uplink to that field, every time you learn something, every time you experience gnosis, every time you experience beauty, you upload automatically. So this is a two-way connection, remember. So it's not just things that go down, it's what you upload into it. So that's the purpose of life, to improve the frequency and the resolution of this thing, because it is us, it is consciousness, and that is where we live within the field. We just beam down into our brains moment by moment. It isn't where we actually live. So if you think in those terms, the guy sat in the cave who is improving himself, experiencing reality, moving mindfully through every moment, experiencing the flowers and the trees and the skies and the birds and everything else, his perceptions with such crystal clear, unadulterated clarity improve the overall thing for everybody. So everything that we do affects everybody. So as you said earlier on, if you focus on the bad stuff all the time and all the grime and dirt, then that becomes your tunnel, that becomes your uplink. So your connection to the field is characterized by what is in your consciousness from moment to moment. So it pays to have focus on what gives you energy. If it feels good and it gives you energy, you should do it. Exercising, morality, and all the rest of it is just automatic, because it's just all common sense, that stuff. So that's the way one has to move on this path.
Very good. Excellent points, Neil, and thank you very much for rounding that up for us in the first segment here. Again, the website, I want to mention it, thecleaver.blogspot.com. Do take a look. It's tons of writing, interesting material, and things that you can learn and grow from if you take a look around there. So with that, thank you very much, Neil, for this first segment here. But do stay with us. We'll take a short break, but we'll be right back.
Thank you.
As you know, we are going to continue our conversation with Neil Kramer in our member section. And we're going to get into the increasing polarity of consciousness, the difficulty to relate to people around you, either at work or your family, people who are stuck in problems or stuck in the media circus, who haven't gotten in contact with themselves and awakened yet. We're also going to talk about free will, 4D, and the CERN facility, the essence or the soul of a person, and how the occult media spinners are manifesting their reality through you, if you aren't aware of it. And we'll round things up to talk about Philip K. Dick and his Valis, downloading Gnosis, peering into the future, and how it could be possible to know about future events, and much more. So don't miss our excellent continuation with Neil Kramer, available now in our member section. If you're not a member and want to tune in, simply head on over to our website, redicecreations.com. Click on subscribe and follow the easy steps to sign up, get instant access, and tune in. We have a lot of audio and video material waiting for you in our member section, so do take advantage of it. Thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren. My name is Henrik. Thank you for listening to our first segment. We'll talk more after this break.